Our Sprawling Supersize Utopia by David Brooks. You're living in the age of the Great Dispersal. Americans continue to move from the Northeast and Midwest to the South and West. But the truly historic migration is from the inner suburbs to the outer suburbs to the suburbs of suburbia. From New Hampshire down to Georgia, across Texas to Arizona, and up through California, you now have the booming exurban sprawls that have broken free of the gravitational pull of the cities, and now float in a new space far beyond them. For example, the population of metropolitan Pittsburgh has declined by 8% since 1980, but as people spread out, the amount of developed land in the Pittsburgh area increased by nearly 43%. The population of Atlanta increased by 22,000 during the 90s, but the expanding suburbs grew by 2.1 million. The geography of work has been turned upside down. Jobs used to be concentrated in downtowns. But the suburbs now account for more rental office space than the cities in most of the major metro areas of the country except Chicago and New York. In the Bay Area in California, suburban Santa Clara County alone has five times as many of the region's larger public companies as San Francisco. 90% of the office space built in America by the end of the 1990s was built in suburbia, much of it in far-flung office parks stretched along the interstates. These new spaces are huge and hugely attractive to millions of people. Mesa, Arizona, a suburb of Phoenix, now has a larger population than Minneapolis, St. Louis or Cincinnati. It's as if Zeus came down and started plopping vast developments in the middle of farmland and the desert overnight. Boom. A master plan community. Boom. A big box mall. Boom. A rec center and 4,000 soccer fields. The food courts come and the people follow. How many times in American history have 300,000-person communities materialized practically out of nothing? In these new, exploding suburbs, the geography, the very landscape of life, is new and unparalleled. In the first place, there are no centers, no recognizable borders, to shape a sense of geographic identity. Throughout human history, most people have lived around some definable place of tribal ring. An oasis, a river junction, a port, a town square. But in exurbia, each individual has his or her own polycentric nodes, the school, the church, and the office park. Life is different in ways big and small. When the New Jersey Devils won the Stanley Cup, they had their victory parade in a parking lot. No downtown street is central to the team's fans. Robert Lang, a demographer at Virginia Tech, compares these new sprawling exurbs to the dark matter in the universe, stuff that is very hard to define but somehow accounts for more mass than all the planets, stars, and moons put together. We are having a hard time understanding the cultural implications of this new landscape, because when it comes to suburbia, our imaginations are motionless. Many of us still live with the suburban stereotypes laid down by the first wave of suburban critics, that the suburbs are dull, white bread kind of places, where Ozzie and Harriet families go to raise their kids. But there are no people so conformist as those who fault the supposed conformity of the suburbs. They regurgitate the same critics decade after decade, regardless of the suburban reality flowering around them. The reality is that modern suburbia is merely the latest iteration of the American dream. Far from being dull, artificial, and spiritually vacuous, today's suburbs are the products of the same religious longings and the same deep tensions that produced the American identity from the start. The complex faith of Jonathan Edwards, the propelling ambition of Benjamin Franklin, the dark, meritocratic fatalism of Lincoln, all these inheritances have shaped the outer suburbs. At the same time the suburbs were sprawling, they were getting more complicated and more interesting, and they were going quietly berserk. When you move through suburbia from the old inner ring suburbs out through the most distant exurbs, you see the most unexpected things: lesbian dentists, Iranian McMansions, Korean megachurches, outlaw biker sub-developments, Orthodox shtetls with Hasidic families walking past strip malls on their way to shul. When you actually live in suburbia, you see that radically different cultural zones are emerging. usually within a few miles of one another, and in places that are as architecturally interesting as a piece of aluminum siding. That's because in the age of the Great Dispersal, it becomes much easier to search out and congregate with people who are basically like yourself. People are less tied down to a factory, a mine, or a harbor. They have more choice over which sort of neighborhood to live in. Society becomes more segmented, and everything that was once hierarchical turns granular. You don't have to travel very far in America to see radically different sorts of people, most of whom know very little about the communities and subcultures just down the highway. For example, if you are driving across the northern band of the country, especially in Vermont, Massachusetts, Wisconsin, or Oregon, you are likely to stumble across a crunchy suburb. These are places with meat-free food co-ops, pottery galleries, sandal shops, because people with progressive politics have a strange penchant for faux exhibitionism. Not many people in these places know much about the for-profit sector of the economy, but they do build wonderful Lawood playgrounds for their kids, who tend to have names like Milo and Mandela. You know you're in a crunchy suburb because you see the anti-lawns, which declare just how fervently crunchy suburbanites reject the soul-destroying standards of conventional success. Anti-lawns look like regular lawns with eating disorders. Some are bare patches of dirt, others are scraggly spreads of ragged, weed-like vegetation, the horticultural version of a grunge rocker's face. Then a few miles away, you might find yourself in an entirely different cultural zone, in an upscale suburban town center packed with restaurants, one of those communities that perform the neat trick of being clearly suburban while still making it nearly impossible to park. The people here tend to be lawyers, doctors, and professors, and they drive around in Volvos, Audis, and Saabs because it is socially acceptable to buy a luxury car as long as it comes from a country hostile to U.S. foreign policy. Here you can find your Trader Joe's grocery stores where all the cashiers look as if they are on loan from Amnesty International, and all the snack food is especially designed for kids who come home from school screaming, "Mom, I want a snack that will prevent colorectal cancer." Here you've got newly renovated arts and crafts 7-bedroom homes whose owners have developed views on beveled granite. No dinner party in this clique has gone all the way to dessert without a conversational phase on the merits and demerits of Corian countertops. Bathroom tile is their cocaine. Instead of white powder, they blow their life savings on handcrafted Italian wall covering from Waterworks. You travel a few miles from these upscale enclaves, and suddenly you're in yet another cultural milieu. You're in one of the suburban light industry zones, and you start noting small Asian groceries offering like tilapia fish and pre-made bibimbap dishes. You see Indian video rental outlets with movies straight from Bollywood. You notice a Japanese bookstore, newspaper boxes offering the Korea Central Daily News, and hair salons offering Dynasty phone cards to brew. One out of every 9 people in America was born in a foreign country. Immigrants used to settle in cities and then migrate out, but now many head straight for suburbia. So today you see little Taiwanese girls in the figure skating clinics, Ukrainian boys learning to pitch, and hints of Cholo culture spreading across Nevada. People here develop their own customs and patterns that grow up largely unnoticed by the general culture. You go to a scraggly playing field on a Saturday morning, and there is a crowd of Nigerians playing soccer. You show up the next day and it is all Mexicans kicking a ball around. No lifestyle magazine is geared to the people who live in these immigrant-heavy wholesale warehouse zones. You drive farther out, and suddenly you're lost in the shapeless, mostly middle-class expanse of exurbia. The inner-ring suburbs tend to have tremendous income inequality. Those who live out here are very likely living in the cultural shadow of golf. It's not so much the game of golf that influences manners and morals, it's the zen-like golf ideal. The perfect human being, defined by golf, is competitive and success-oriented, yet calm and neat while casually dressed. Everything he owns looks as if it is made of titanium, from his driver to his BlackBerry, to his wife's Wonder Bra. He has achieved mastery over the great dragons, hurry, anxiety, and disorder. His DVD collection is organized, as is his walk-in closet. His car is clean and vacuumed. His frequently dialed numbers are programmed into his phone, and his rate plan is well-tailored to his needs. His casual slacks are well-pressed, and he is so calm and together that next to him, Dick Cheney looks bipolar. The new suburbs appeal to him because everything is fresh and neat. The philosopher George Santayana once suggested that Americans don't solve problems, we just leave them behind. The exurbanite has left behind that exorbitant mortgage, that long commute, all those weird people who watch my daughter as a slut on daytime TV talk shows. He has come to be surrounded by regular, friendly people who do not scoff at his daughter's competitive cheerleading obsession and whose wardrobes are as lands independent as his is. Exurban places have one ideal that soars above all others: ample parking. You can drive diagonally across acres of empty parking spaces on your way from bed, bath, and beyond to linens and things. These parking lots are so big that you could recreate the Battle of Gettysburg in the middle, and nobody would notice at the stores on either end. Off on one side, partly obscured by the curvature of the earth, you will see a sneaker warehouse big enough to qualify for membership in the United Nations, and then at the other end there will be a Home Depot. Still, shoppers measure their suburban manliness by how close they can park to the Best Buy. So if the normal healthy American sees a family about to pull out of one of those treasured close-in spots just next to the maternity ones, he will put on his blinker and wait for the departing family to load up its minivan and apparently read a few chapters of Ulysses before it finally pulls out and lets him slide in. You look out across this landscape, with its sprawling diversity of suburban types, and sometimes you can't help considering the possibility that we Americans may not be the most profound people on earth. You look out across the suburban landscape, that is the essence of modern America, and you see the culture of Slurp and Gulps, McDonald's, Disney, breast enlargements, and The Bachelor. You see a country that gave us Prozac and Viagra, paper party hats, pinball machines, commercial jingles, expensive orthodontia, and monster truck rallies. You see a trashy consumer culture that has perfected parade floats, corporate sponsorship deals, low-slung jeans, and frosted Cocoa Puffs, a culture that finds its quintessential means of self-expression through bumper stickers "Rehab is for quitters." Indeed, over the past half century, there has been an endless flow of novels, movies, anti-sprawl tracts, essays, and pop songs all lamenting the shallow conformity of suburban life. If you scan these documents all at once, or even if, like the average person, you absorb them over the course of a lifetime, you find their depictions congeal into the same sorry scene. Suburban America is a comfortable but somewhat vacuous realm of unreality, consumerist, wasteful, complacent, materialistic, and self-absorbed. Disneyfied Americans, in this view, have become too concerned with small and vulgar pleasures, pointless one-upmanship. Their lives are distracted by a buzz of trivial images, by relentless hurry instead of contemplation, information rather than wisdom, and a profusion of unsatisfying lifestyle choices. Modern suburban Americans, it is argued, rarely sink to the level of depravity. They are too tepid for that, but they don't achieve the highest virtues or the most demanding excellences. These criticisms don't get suburbia right. They don't get America right. The criticisms tend to come enshrouded in predictions of decline or cultural catastrophe. Yet somehow imperial decline never comes, and the social catastrophe never materializes. American standards of living surpass those in Europe, around 1740. For more than 260 years, in other words, Americans have been rich, money-mad, vulgar, materialistic, and complacent people. And yet somehow America became, and continues to be, the most powerful nation on earth, and the most productive. Religion flourishes. Universities flourish. Crime rates drop. Teen pregnancy declines. Teen suicide rates fall, along with divorce rates. Despite all the problems that plague this country, social healing takes place. If we are so great, can we really be that shallow? Nor do the standard critics of suburbia really solve the mystery of motivation, the inability of many Americans to sit still, even when they sincerely want to simplify their lives. Americans are the hardest working people on earth. The average American works 350 hours a year, nearly 10 weeks more than the average Western European. Americans switch jobs more frequently than people from other nations. The average job tenure in the U.S. is 6.8 years, compared with more than a decade in France, Germany, and Japan. What propels Americans to live so feverishly, even against their own self-interest? What energy source accounts for all this? Finally, the critics don't explain the dispersion. They don't explain why so many millions of Americans throw themselves into the unknown every year. In 2002, about 14.2% of Americans relocated. Compare that with the 4% of Dutch and Germans, and the 8% of Britons who move in a typical year. According to one survey, only slightly more than a quarter of American teenagers expect to live in their hometowns as adults. What sort of longing causes people to pick up and head out for the horizon? Why do people uproot their families from California, New York, Ohio, and elsewhere, and move into new developments in Arizona or Nevada or North Carolina, imagining their kids at high schools that haven't even been built yet, picturing themselves with new friends they haven't yet met, fantasizing about touch football games on lawns that haven't been seeded? Millions of people every year leap out into the void, heading out to communities that don't exist, to office parks that are not yet finished, to places where everything is new. This mysterious longing is the root of the great dispersal. To grasp that longing, you have to take seriously the central cliché of American life, the American dream. Albert Einstein once said that imagination is more important than knowledge, and when you actually look at modern mainstream America, you see what a huge role fantasy plays even in the seemingly dullest areas of life. The suburbs themselves are conservative utopias, where people go because they imagine orderly and perfect lives can be led there. This is the nation of Hollywood, Las Vegas, professional wrestling, Elvis impersonators, penthouse letters, computer gamers, grown men in LeBron James basketball jerseys, faith healers, and the whole range of ampersand magazines, town and country, food and wine, that display perfect parties, perfect homes, perfect vacations, and perfect lives. This is the land of rainforest cafe-themed restaurants, Ralph Lauren wasp fantasy fashions, Civil War reenactors, gated communities with names, like Sherwood Forest, and vehicles with names, like Yukon, Durango, Expedition, and Mustang, as if their accountant owners were going to chase down some cattle rustlers on the way to the Piggly Wiggly. This is the land in which people dream of the most Walter Mitty-esque personal transformations as a result of the low CARB diet, cosmetic surgery, or their move to the Sun Belt. Americans, seemingly bland, ordinary Americans, often have a remarkably tenuous grip on reality. Under the seeming superficiality of suburban American life, there is an imaginative fire that animates Americans and propels us to work so hard, move so much, and leap so wantonly. Ralph Waldo Emerson once wrote that those who complain of the flatness of American life have no perception of its destiny. They are not Americans. They don't see that here is man in the Garden of Eden, here, the Genesis, and the Exodus. And here, he concluded fervently, will come the final revelation. Emerson was expressing the eschatological longing, that is the essence of the American identity, the assumption that some culminating happiness is possible here, that history can be brought to a close here. The historian Zach Van Bercevich has observed that the United States is the example par excellence of a nation formed by collective fantasy. Despite all the claims that American culture is materialist and pragmatic, what is striking about this country is how material things are shot through with enchantment. America, after all, was born in a frenzy of imagination. For the first European settlers, and for all the subsequent immigrants, the new continent begs to be fantasized about. The early settlers were aware of and almost oppressed by the obvious potential of the land. They saw the possibility of plenty everywhere, yet at the start they lived in harsh conditions. Their lives took on a slingshot shape they had to pull back in order to someday shoot forward. Through the temporary hardships they dwelt imaginatively in the grandeur that would inevitably mark their future. This future-minded mentality deepened decade after decade, century after century. Each time the early settlers pushed west, they found what was to them virgin land, and they perceived it as paradise. Fantasy about the future lured them. Guide who led, and sometimes exploited the 19th century pioneers were shocked by how little the trekkers often knew about the surroundings they had thrown themselves into, or what would be involved in their new lives. As so often happens in American history, as happens every day in the newly sprawling areas, people leapt before they really looked. Americans found themselves drawn to places where the possibility seemed boundless, and where there was no history. Francis Parkman, the great 19th century historian, wrote of his youthful self, "His thoughts were always in the forest, whose features possessed his waking and sleeping dreams, filling him with vague cravings impossible to satisfy." Our minds are still with Parkman's, in the forest. Our imagination still tricks us into undertaking grand projects, starting a business, writing a book, raising a family, moving to a new place, by enchanting us with visions of future joys. When these tasks turn out to be more difficult than we dreamed, the necessary exertions bring out new skills and abilities, and make us better than we planned on being. And so we see the distinctive American mentality, which explains the westward crossing as much as the suburban sprawl, and the frenzy.com style enthusiasms. It is the paradise spell, the tendency to see the present from the vantage point of the future. It starts with imagination, the ability to fantasize about what some imminent happiness will look like. Then a future-minded person leaps rashly toward that gauzy image. He or she is subtly more attached to the glorious future than to the temporary and unsatisfactory present. Time isn't pushed from the remembered past to the felt present to the mysterious future. It is pulled by the golden future from the unsatisfactory present, and away from the dim past. There's a James Fenimore Cooper novel called The Pioneers, in which a developer takes his cousin on a tour of the city he is building. He describes the broad streets, the rows of houses. But all she sees is a barren forest. He's astonished she can't see it, so real is it in his mind already. Mentality matters, and sometimes mentality is all that matters. The cognitive strands established early in American history, and through its period of explosive growth, a sense that some ultimate fulfillment will be realized here, that final happiness can be created here, that the United States has a unique mission to redeem the world, are still woven into the fabric of everyday life. The old impulses, fevers, and fantasies still play themselves out amid the Blackberries, the Hummers, the closet organizers, and the travel team softball leagues. Suburban America is a bourgeois place, but unlike some other bourgeois places, it is also a transcendent place infused with everyday utopianism. That's why you meet so many boring-looking people who see themselves on some technological frontier, dreaming of this innovation or that management technique that will elevate the world, and half the time their enthusiasms, crazes, and fads seem ludicrous to others, and even to them, in retrospect. We members of this suburban empire still find ourselves veering off into world crises, roaring into battle with visions of progressive virtue on our side, and retrograde evil on the other, waging moralistic crusades others do not understand, pushing our movie, TV, and rock star fantasies onto an ambivalent and sometimes horrified globe. This doesn't mean all Americans, or even all suburban Americans, think alike, simply that there is a prevailing current to national life that you feel when you come here from other places with other currents. Some nations are bound, in all their diversity, by a common creation myth, a tale of how they came into being. Americans are bound, in all our diversity, by a fruition myth. Born in abundance, inspired by opportunity, nurtured in imagination, spiritualized by a sense of God's blessing and call, and realized in ordinary life day by day, this paradise spell is the controlling ideology of national life. Just out of reach, just beyond the next ridge, just in the farther out suburb, or with the next entrepreneurial scheme, just with the next diet plan or credit card purchase, the next true love or political hero, the next summer home or all-terrain vehicle, the next meditation technique or motivational seminar, just with the right schools, the right moral revival, the right beer, and the right set of buddies. Just with the next technology, or after the next shopping spree, there is this spot you can get to where all tensions will melt, all time pressures will be relieved, and happiness can be realized. The spare dice spell is at the root of our tendency to work so hard, consume so feverishly, to move so much. It inspires our illimitable faith in education, our frequent born-again experiences. It explains why, alone among developed nations, we have shaped our welfare system to encourage opportunity at the expense of support and security, and why, more than people in comparable nations, we wreck our families and move on. It is the call that makes us heedless of the past, disrespectful toward traditions, short on contemplation, wasteful in our use of the things around us, impious toward restraints, but consumed by hope, driven ineluctably to improve, fervently optimistic, relentlessly aspiring, spiritually alert, and, in this period of human history, the irresistible and discombobulating locomotive of the world. David Brooks is a Times columnist. His new book, On Paradise Drive, How We Live Now and Always Have, in the Future Tense, from which this essay is adapted, will be published next month by Simon & Schuster,